Today's Taisho will be on case 19 in the Mumonkan, in the Gate of No Barrier. Case 19 is Nonsense, Ordinary Mind is the Way. Joshu asked Nonsense, what is the way? Ordinary mind is the way, Nonsense replied. Shall I try to seek after it? Joshu asked. If you try for it, you will become separated from it, responded Nonsense. How can I know the way unless I try for it? Persisted Joshu. Nonsense said, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, not knowing is confusion. When you have really reached the true way beyond doubt, you will find it as vast and boundless as outer space. How can it be talked about on the level of right and wrong? With these words, Joshu came to a sudden realization. Mumon's comment, Nonsense dissolved and melted away before Joshu's question and could not offer a plausible explanation. Even though Joshu comes to a realization, he must delve into it for another 30 years before he can fully understand it. Mumon's verse, the spring flowers, the autumn moon, summer breezes, winter snow. If useless things do not clutter your mind, you have the best days of your life. So I want to thank everybody for coming to practice this morning and for sitting so beautifully. Last night we have a person who's been coming really only for about a month maybe, and she is pretty new to Zen, and she asked me, what's with the bowing? You do the bowing. What's that all about? And you know, are there other things I should know? And you know, she was not objecting to the bows. She just wanted to understand them. And I said, you know, actually, in Zen tradition, when people enter the Zendo, they bow. You don't have to, but that's often the case. That's sort of Zen tradition. And then when they face their cushion, they bow. And then we do the three bows together. And this person was very receptive to this. But she was confused about what we're really doing. And I said, you know, in a way it seems silly, right? You're walking into a room and you bow, you face your cushion and you bow. But, you know, I said, stop and think about how just incredibly screwed up the world is, right? I mean, incredibly, right? Just incredibly screwed up. I didn't elaborate on that. I thought the evidence was so overwhelming that it wasn't necessary to give her the litany of screwed up examples of how screwed up, but how deeply, tragically, terribly the world is screwed up. And I said, if you think about what we're doing against that backdrop, you know, something like Buddhism is really extraordinary, right? Like extraordinary. You know, people come here to wake up. You know, they're not getting any money, can't put it on your CV, you know. People are coming here to wake up. You know, on some level, they have deep confidence in the capacity, the possibility of waking up, right? In spite of all of this crap, this unbelievable, terrible stuff. And, you know, I said, actually, the existence of opportunities to practice is incredibly rare and precious. So simply having this room is actually quite wonderful. You know, in Buddhism, we have this idea of cooperating causes. Everything is the consequence of causes and effects. And, you know, sometimes things come together in a way that makes practice possible. And those are called cooperating causes. So it just so happens, through the working of karma, that we have this space. You know, it just so happens, through the working of karma, that people show up here, right? They show up and they do this work. They do the hard work of sitting. A teacher would be good. The Mumonkan, you know, written in 1200, right? These koans collected earlier from the Tang Dynasty and the Song Dynasty. The wisdom of the people who created these koans and the incredible insight. And it's really amazing. So, you know, if you go online, you can see there's like a million places to do meditation. There's all this, you know, meditation is for sale in the marketplace, you know, everywhere you look. But, you know, when you think about how, you know, that's why we bow, right? How amazing that this is possible, right? How amazing that this is possible. Right? That this has not been wiped off the face of the earth, really. So, yes, you know, you don't have to do it, and I don't always do it. But when you walk into the Zendo, I said to her, we bow. We sit, we face the cushion, you know, this is where I am working towards my liberation, my enlightenment. And, you know, this morning coming together, it's just like, oh, another Saturday sit. And it's true, it's just another Saturday. But on the other hand, right, you know, how amazing and how precious that people are willing, that people have enough trust in their big minds to get up and do this, right? Get up and do this. Come sit, do this work, so wonderful. So the koan today is somewhat related to what I just said. This is an encounter between Nanchuan and Zhaozhou. These are like two of the really greatest Zen masters. And Zhaozhou, Zhoushu, is just, he's still learning. And Nanchuan, Nansen, is his teacher, was his teacher for like 40 years, you know. They practiced together for a long time. Zhoushu says to Nansen, what is the way? And Nansen says, ordinary mind is the way. You know, when I was given this koan by my teacher, Genki Roshi, Genki Takabayashi Roshi, and I remember going to this sesshin. My good friend, John Sunston, had a cabin out on what is called the Hood Canal in the Seattle area. It's not really a canal, it's a channel. It's a natural channel. It's like a fjord. And his grandfather built this log cabin. And before we had other places to do a retreat, we did a weekend retreat at this log cabin. And it was quite a crowd, right? I mean, it would be like having our sesshin group in this cabin. It was a bit tight. And Genki Roshi gave me this koan, and I remember just thinking, you know, where is this? How do I answer this koan? I was so frustrated. And, you know, ordinary mind is the way, shall I try to seek after it, Joshua asked, and nonsense is if you try, you separate yourself from it. He says, how can I know the way unless I try for it? Nonsense said, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. And I just couldn't get this. I just couldn't get this. And I was so frustrated. And I remember, I think on the second night of this retreat, you know, I had this, you know, I woke up and I had this dream where I was looking at the wall of the, of this cabin. It's actually quite a lovely place. You know, all of a sudden the Buddha sort of emerged from the wall. This, you know, and then I could see the Buddha. And I went into Genki Roshi and I said, you know, I had this dream, you know, the, I was facing the wall and then the Buddha came out of the wall. And I think Genki Roshi just said, oh, that's nice. You know, ding, that's not the answer, however, right? And it, well, I, you know, it's not. It takes a, you know, a long time for people to sort of get rid of some basic assumptions, right? Ordinary people really don't think much about their minds, right? It's just a fact. You know, people who have stress know they're stressed, and people who have, you know, anxiety disorders or other problems go to therapists, which is a wonderful thing. But even if they go to therapists, they don't really think much about their minds, really, actually. Right? There's all this literature about the mind. Every day there's an article in neuroscience, you know, some new finding in neuroscience. But all the same, you know, people don't really think about their minds. Most people think that they're in reality all the time. This is absolutely the case, you know. So, you know, most people walking around think they're in reality. And they don't pay much attention to their mental processing at all. And, you know, if they're going through the day and they're stressed, they may be, you know, tangentially aware of their stress. And, you know, if somebody cuts them off in traffic, they may get angry. But, you know, nevertheless, you know, they don't really think about what's happening to them in terms of their mind. So this is sort of like the baseline ordinary person, right? For most people, the idea of the mind, you know, it's an arcane subject, better left to scientists maybe, or to psychiatrists and therapists. And as I say, if they have problems, it's like if your car isn't working, you go to a mechanic, and if you have anxiety, you go to a therapist. So it takes a long time for people to realize that there is such a thing as the mind, right? And, you know, one of the things that happens when people meditate, you know, is that there begins to be this split between what they were calling their mind all this time, all these many years, and something else, some other kind of awareness. And this split takes a while to open up, right? So basically, you know, I'm living in reality and I decide, you know, to practice meditation. And maybe something has happened to me. Maybe there's been a tragedy or I'm having some kind of existential challenges or, you know, for some reason, I just decide to practice meditation. And so I start meditating, and I sit down on the cushion. You know, and, you know, maybe I have a lot of thoughts. You know, that's quite typical, right? You know, mind is just buzzing with thoughts. And also, you know, that doesn't surprise anybody, because that's part of what we, that's part of like our everyday reality. You know, we don't sort it out, right? You know, our everyday reality is like, I get up for breakfast and I go in and I say, what will I have for breakfast? And, you decide what you're going to eat for breakfast, you make your coffee, and while you're doing these things, you're having thoughts about work, or you're having thoughts about family issue or health issue. All of that's sort of ordinary reality. That's reality. And when you sit down on the cushion, you know, at first, you know, your legs hurt, or it's a little bit hard to get in this posture, and you have a lot of thoughts. And that's sort of ordinary practice for a long time. You begin to experience your mind as, you know, all these thoughts and these sensations in your leg and so on. That's the mind now. And that's already like a big improvement over ordinary people, right? Ordinary people just think they're in reality all the time. And when you begin to do Zazen, you suddenly become aware of like your mental processing, right? So that's a big step forward, right? You sit down on the cushion and you're deactivating your body. You know, there's no stimulus, right? You know, so there's no TV, there's no cell phone. You know, nothing's going on. It's just you're sitting in a room with other people. The fan is going, the vent is going overhead. There's nothing to engage with, right? And so you begin to notice like there's this mental processing going on. And there's sensations. There's, maybe when you first start sitting, it's hard to get into this posture. It's hard to maintain it. And, you know, you're struggling with your thoughts. You sit down, you know, last night this person I was talking to about bowing is very highly motivated, but, you know, was struggling. Like, you know, after 20 minutes had to move, right? And again after like 15 minutes had to move. And you know, that person might think about what, you know, that person might say, well, on the cushion, you know, my mind is full of thoughts or something like that. So, you know, this is where most people stop. I think in the world of meditation, this is really where like most people stop, right? So when they think of meditation, they think of it on this level, right? So, you know, what I want to do is be calmer, and if I you know, keep coming back to my breath, my thoughts become fewer, and I become less reactive, right? It's like you begin to notice, you know, if you meditate regularly, if you do this often, you know, when things happen to you, you may find that you're less reactive, right? So sometimes something will happen, and you'll just people will go for, they'll instantly feel fear, or they instantly feel threatened or angry or sad. And if you meditate a little while, you know, you begin to have like this spaciousness. So you know, somebody cuts you off in traffic, and instead of like exploding, it's like you see your anger starting to arise, and you realize, I don't have to be angry. You know, I really don't have to go with that emotion. And this is like a real breakthrough for people, right? You know, most people have no space between their emotions and their experience of awareness, right? So their emotion is the awareness. It's like, you know, I'm driving, and then angry, you know, and when people begin to meditate, there begins to be this spaciousness, right? You realize that, you know, your sensations arise and your sensations go away. So, you know, if you watch the breath for a while, you have some pain in your leg, And if you don't move, you know, the pain sort of drifts off again, right? And then something else comes up, you know, and that drifts away. And then, you know, you may have a memory and that may trigger some emotions, but that drifts away. And there begins to be this spaciousness, right? And a lot of people associate meditation practice with this, with what I'm describing. And they become less reactive, they feel more centered, they feel more calm. And all of that's wonderful and so great. So if you want to be more alert at work, you know, just do some meditation. If you want to be less reactive, just do some meditation. If you want to be, more response, you know, rapidly responsive, you know, they've done, my friend John Sunston, the guy who had the log cabin, he was a brain scientist, you know, and he did all these, he was one of the pioneering brain scientists who did all of this work. He was in the medical school at the University of Washington. And he did all of this work with meditators. He was in one of these original research teams, right? And they found that, you know, if you meditate, your reflexes get much better. You know, you can respond much more quickly, you know. That was one of the studies he did. I'm not sure it helped him to be a brain scientist, because when he would be meditating, he'd be thinking about all the brain chemistry going on, right? He'd say, oh, now this is happening, right? And now this is happening. So actually that got in his way, right? But that's a very, thinking about the meditation and the brain, right, is very common these days. You know, you'll hear people say that when you meditate, you know, you're going deeper and deeper down the brain stem, right? That kind of thing. But all of that's one way of understanding mind, right? Most people don't have any understanding of mind. And they go to a therapist, and the therapist starts asking them questions, and they suddenly realize there are things in there they don't understand, right? That they never even thought about, that they've repressed all their lives. So that then they come to meditate, and they realize, oh, there's all this mental activity going on. So there's thoughts, sensations, and conditioned responses. And if I just watch my breath, if I just work on my meditation practice, I'll be less liable to fall into these reactive conditioned responses. There's more spaciousness around me. I'll be calmer and more centered. And that's wonderful. And that's such an improvement, right, over the way people ordinarily are. But actually, there's something deeper than that, right? There's something deeper than that. If you stopped there, right? If you stopped there, from a Zen standpoint, from a Buddhist standpoint, you would have been, it really would be like arrested development, actually, right? Because your relationship to your mind is really like the relationship of a car owner to a car, right? So, you know, if your car is, we come to a stop, it's sort of, it almost shuts off and not quite. There's maybe some stuck valve. You know, you take it to the shop, and the guy will, you know, charge you $1,000 and fix it, right? You know. That's sort of like that relationship to the mind, right? You know, so we want a calmer mind, we meditate, we want to be less reactive, we meditate. It's like we're the owner of the car and the mind is the car. And that's a very common view of the mind. But that's not the view, that's not the deepest experience, right? So, you know, when we Zen people can enter samadhi, you know, when you're not fidgeting anymore and you're not entirely caught up in thoughts, right, you know, you begin to enter this place that's very still and grounded, right? Still and grounded. And it often feels very good too. It feels nice, right? That's a samadhi. And there are different ways of experiencing samadhi. Some people experience it as weightlessness. Some people experience it as like being like a mountain, sitting like a mountain. Some people feel like spider webs. You know, there's all these different ways of experiencing samadhi. But when you experience samadhi, you're in an altered state of consciousness. You know, and you're not self-referencing anymore. You're just experiencing this moment by moment awareness, which is decentered. There really isn't like a mind anymore. It's just like this moment of awareness and this moment of awareness and this moment of awareness. But then, you know, in the Zen tradition, we do what's called emptiness meditation. You know, and we say, instead of watching moments of awareness, instead of watching the breath and following the breath, you know, we follow the breath out until at the end of the breath the mind becomes blank. And for a long time, meditating on that blankness is a challenge, right? For people who are doing this, it's a challenge. It's, you know, for some period of time you've focused your attention on your breath, and now the teacher is saying, don't focus on the breath, don't focus on anything at all. Just say mu. And the mind becomes blank. And this is one of the most challenging moments in practicing Zen. Because a lot of the time people don't want to be in that blank place, right? The mind, mental habits are powerful, and one feels uncomfortable sometimes in that place. And, you know, the mind wants to return to, you know, thinking, because that's so familiar, right? Even if your thinking drives you crazy, and even if your thinking catches you up in these loops, at least it's familiar. And when you go out at the end of the breath, there's this blank place, and you keep going back there for a long time. That's very challenging, and it feels a lot like there's just nothing there. It's like trying to hold on to nothing, or trying to focus on nothing. And as I say, this is really like the most challenging period in Zen practice. And I think it's probably the case that more people quit at this moment, you know, in that intervening period than at any other time in Zen practice. So I once read this book by this Zen teacher in Toronto, the man who founded the Toronto Zen Center. And his name is Albert Lowe, L-O-W-E. And Albert Lowe said that when he was training, I think he was training in Los Angeles at the LA Zen Center. And he said that he was actually working with Mu for a number of years. And he said that was the toughest period, right? Because he said, I just felt like I was sitting in a cold, dark room day after day after day. Sometimes it may not feel cold, but it's just like this vacuum, this vacuity, right? You know. And you just keep going into this blankness and thinking, what the hell? But you know, when you go into that blankness, it's a little bit like a person who is outside in the sunny day. And you open a door and you go into a dark room, right? And your pupils have contracted to protect you from the sunlight. And you go into this dark room and you see absolutely nothing, right? And it takes a minute for your pupils to enlarge, right, so that you can get a little bit more light into your eyes. And gradually you realize this is not just a blank space, there's all this stuff in here, right? A Zen practice on emptiness meditation is a lot like that, right? It's like coming out of the sun into a dark room, and if somebody asks you what's there, you'd say nothing, nothing, nothing. But it's like if you stay in that blankness for a long time, it begins to deeply transform. It's like purification. One way to put it would be to say that our awareness is very crude. It's so crude, and how crude is it? It's so crude that right now in this room, Buddha mind is blazing away like 1,000 suns. So help me. But people don't see it, because their senses are too crude. There's this wonderful collection of stories. It's like 11 volumes called The Transmission of the Lamp. It's a Chinese Buddhist classic. And this great poet wrote this history of Zen. And it's fantastic. It's available in English translation now. And in one of the little vignettes, when we get to Nagarjuna, the author of the Transmission of the Lamp said, when Nagarjuna, one of our Dharma ancestors, entered this room to give a talk, the enlightened people could see it was like the sun blazing in the room. And the people who weren't yet fully awake just saw this little fat guy up on the stage, right? Nagarjuna was supposed to be small, rotund, unassuming guy, right? And people just thought, who's that little guy, right? The great, deeply awakened guy, man. But they couldn't see it because their senses were too crude, see? So that's how crude our senses are. And Zen says that if you just keep refining the mind, right, you just keep refining the mind, it's like little by little, it's like your eyes adjust and adjust and adjust and adjust until you can see it. So basically, when you're working with emptiness, it's tedious sometimes to, you're trying to face that emptiness and all this stuff comes up. So you're calling Mu and you have this moment of blankness and then you start thinking about something and it's so frustrating. And then you come back and then you have this memory of your childhood, right? And it's so frustrating. But it's like that process is deeply purifying. And after a while, it's like your eyes begin to adjust to the darkness. And it's like you're becoming a different person. This is so challenging, but so important. And at first, that emptiness feels so uncomfortable, right? And gradually, you begin to feel this affinity or kinship, right? It's like human beings are like, we're like dolphins, in a swimming pool. And, when we are put in the water in the ocean, right, we still behave like we're in the pool. And when you're you're entering the ocean of Mu. You know, first we just behave like we're still in a little pool. But gradually we realize that this is our home. This is where we really belong. And our relationship to that emptiness changes like profoundly. And this is the most, really the most, one of the most, really I would say the most important transition people undergo. And, you know, you go back into that emptiness again and again. And when you do that, you know, it's so purifying because all of your stuff comes up, right? All of your junk comes up. You know, this and this and this and, you know, all kinds of things come up. You know, I've talked about the fact before that, you know, my brother was he was like an athlete. He was so handsome, you know, and he was physically, he was just physically beautiful person. And you know, when we were teenagers, my brother, you know, he would just go to the pool and all of these girls would be surrounding my brother. It was like, and none of them would come up to me because I was just this scrawny little guy with big ears. And you know, my parents just loved my brother so much, and they loved me, of course, but you know, these kinds of things come up sometimes when you practice. You know, you close the door on all this and it all comes up, right? And that's so good, right? That's so beneficial, right? That stuff comes up. And, you know, you didn't want to deal with it, and now you have to, and then you go back into the emptiness. And then something else comes up, right? You know? things in our lives that have closed us up and made us less open, less perceptive, more crude. You know, when I was in Baltimore, my father was stationed in Baltimore, and I made these friends that were like, they were like my brothers, right? Mark and Jeff. And we would go over to each other's house, we would sleep, and, you know, sleep together, you know, we were just little kids. And when we moved, when we had to leave Baltimore, and we went to D.C., I think it was, or maybe San Diego. You know, I was so, it was like, it would be like losing your best friends, you know, and you say, oh, he's just a little kid. But, you know, after that, I really had no friends for the longest time, right? It was just like, I just went to school, and I came home, and I had no friends. Because, you know, those guys, I loved them so much. I don't even know where they are now. So all of these things close us up. You know, all of these things. After that, it was like, I'm not going to make contact with any human beings again. Of course, I eventually did. But, you know, these things close us up. And when we go into that emptiness, we start, like, working through all of these things that are obstacles that make us crude-spirited, make our perception crude. And it's like your eyes gradually begin to adjust. Right? It's not so much that you see something. It's that you feel something. Right? It's not like you suddenly see the Buddha coming out of the wall. It's like you begin to feel something. It's like we're so, you know, we're so locked up, we're so unnatural in how we live. It's like we're all, you know, I don't know if you've ever had this experience where you've been very tense and then you come home and you realize, geez, you know, I'm so tense, every muscle in my body is waiting for a blow, you know. But we're all like that, actually. We're all, you know, a lot of scar tissue and a lot of injuries. And, you know, it's like you're a closed fist all your life, and then you start working with emptiness and you begin to open your hand. And that's so wonderful. So it's not so much that you see things now as that it's like, at first there's like this little, it's like a stirring of something, like stirring. It's like in the Mumon Khan, it's called subconscious stirring. It's like something's stirring in that emptiness. And gradually you begin to feel like it's like energy. It's like the dead person coming back to life. It's like a dead person coming to life. All, I didn't know it, but I've been dead all this time, and now I'm coming back to life. And, you know, in our tradition of Zen, we actually ask people, we don't do it here in the building, but at Sesshin, sometimes the teacher will ask you to call Mu, actually call it out loud. And, you know, people come into the Dokusan room and the teacher might say, please call Mu. You've been focusing on this emptiness, call Mu. And people will think, oh, you're kidding, like, call Mu. And you go, Mu. You know, it's not really calling Mu. I mean, you've been sitting with that emptiness, right? I want to hear the voice of that emptiness. And, you know, maybe people start calling, you know, it's not just like, moo. They really start calling from deep in their entrails, right? Like from your guts, from the bottom of your heart. Right? You're calling moo. And at first you feel like such a horse's ass. It's like you're coming in there and you're, and some people try to perform, right? They try to have a mighty moo. But what you really have to do is completely empty yourself out and be in that emptiness and allow that energy to flow through your body. It's like a possession, like a divine, it's not demonic possession, it's like divine possession. Right? So you have to let that, you have to find that energy. And at first it's just like a little something. It's just not a dead void anymore. And then you realize there's a kind of energy. I get a kind of energy vibe when I sit in this emptiness, you know. And sometimes it becomes very powerful. It's like vibrating. Like. And then you have to come into the teacher and, you know, you feel like such an ass. It's like, you know, for the longest time. And you think, I'm going to screw this up. But at some point, you know, you just empty yourself out and you let that energy flow through you. And it's like, where did that come from? Where did that come from? It's like ordinary people live in, like, reality, they think. It's not reality. But they think it is. And then, you know, when they start practicing meditation, they think they're encountering their mind, this thing that can be calm or agitated or grounded or not grounded. But that's like an intermediate level. It's not really the mind. It's just an intermediate level, right? You know, when you go into deep mushin, you begin to experience mind. This energy, you know. And you empty yourself out and you let it flow through your body. And this is like a totally different, now you're not, you know, in my opinion, you're not even a human being anymore. There's a very famous encounter, Brahman saw the Buddha walking down the street and the Buddha was, his face was just glowing. And the Buddha said, and this guy said to the Buddha, oh, are you a man? Are you a human? And the Buddha said, no. And the Brahman was quite ready to believe the next thing. He said, well, are you a god? And the Buddha said, no. And the Brahman said, well, what are you? And the Buddha said, I'm awake. You know, when we encounter mind, not the mind that thinks or that doesn't think or that worries about having too many thoughts, or that thinks about his brother being more beloved and so on, there's this deep, there's this deeper, deeper, deeper level. And that's where we do our work. We have to learn how to make ourselves available to that. You can't make it come. You can't sit down on the cushion and go, on, turn on, right? It's not like your car, right? It's not like a car. It's the, I'm the servant, you know, basically that's the master. So I have to make myself available by doing lots of zazen. And sometimes that energy arises. Sometimes it doesn't, it's nowhere to be found, that's okay. But you have to make yourself available, and if you make yourself available, it's like suddenly you're like that dolphin who returns to the ocean. You know, it's like I am home at last. I am in my home. I'm a creature of the deep sea, and so are you. How wonderful to be home, and so precious. Like nothing else in the world. Joshu asked Nansen, what is the way? Ordinary mind is the way, Nansen said. Now okay, so my mind is like a car, right? You know, I can tune it up, I can get better mileage, right? But no, that's not what he's talking about. Shall I seek after it? Joshu asked. If you try for it, you will become separated from it, responded Nansen. How can I know the way unless I try for it? Persisted Joshu. Nansen said, the way is not a matter of knowing or not knowing. Knowing is delusion, not knowing is confusion. When you have reached the true way beyond doubt, you will find it as vast and boundless as space. How can it be talked about on the level of right or wrong? With these words, Joshu came to a sudden realization. Mumon's comment, Nansen dissolved and melted away before Joshu's question and could not offer a plausible explanation. No. When Mumon says that, he's actually delivering a compliment. It sounds like he's knocking Nansen, but he's actually saying Nansen did a great job. Even though Joshu comes to a realization, he must delve into it for another 30 years before he can fully understand it. It's not about understanding, right? There's no end to practice. We can't make it happen. We can't control it. Anybody who thinks that he is a master of the process is deluding himself. You know, our job is to come here and sit down and empty ourselves out and make ourselves available to the big mind, to that energy. And when we do that, we're totally transformed. Totally. Spring flowers, autumn moon, summer breezes, winter snow. If useless things do not clutter your mind, you have the best days of your life.